Cultivate Simple, episode 27, Pondering Ponds.
I'd rather be a farmer. I'd rather work the land. I'd rather see the mountainsides. I'd rather see your hand. I'd rather swim the ocean. I'd rather not pretend.
Welcome to Cultivate Simple, an honest and unrehearsed discussion about trying to live a more simple life. And this is episode 27, and today we are pondering on ponds. And my name is Mr. Chiutz, a.k.a. Brian Morris, a.k.a. the Timber Framer. And I am joined by my lovely wife and always faithful co-host, Mrs. Chiutz, a.k.a. Susie.
Yeah, nobody ever calls me Mrs. Chiutz. I'm just Susie.
No. So, we've had yet another busy week. I just got back from a timber framing class, which, if you don't know what timber framing is, basically you go out into the woods, you cut down trees, you make big 8x8 or 6x6 timbers, and then using no screws, you put it all together and, you know, different joinery and so on. Very interesting. And I'm sure that we'll be talking about it in the future because we're going to be using timber framing techniques for at least a shed, possibly a greenhouse, and maybe some animal shelter like a new chicken coop and some other things. So had the opportunity to go take a class on it and learned from one of the main timber framers, and main with an E, timber framers, and it was just really great. It was fun. And because of that, we're now members of the Hidden Valley
Nature Conservatory.
I don't know what the last word is. Yeah, met a lot of good people and had a lot of fun. And speaking of meeting a lot of good people, we have someone living with us. We have, if you didn't see the post on the blog this past week, we're still deciding what to call him, I suppose.
Now he needs a pseudonym like you.
Like Mr. Chiutz.
Blog readers come up with something.
He could be Mr. Handyman around the farm. He could be Mr. Instigator because...
It's nice because now I have someone on my side.
It's now two against one when we take a vote on if we should get pigs or if we should get sheep or if we should get goats or if we should get anything. And he's always voting yes. Where, I don't know. I think my vote should count for two. But anyway, so we have Dalen with us, and he's going to be staying with us on and off through Thanksgiving and helping us out to get set up. We really needed some extra hands because I am super busy with real world work.
The thing that pays for
the thing that actually pays for bills.
That pays for all of our hobbies.
Right. And it was worth it for me to work a few extra hours a week in order to have him around helping out. Because moving from Ohio, we really left behind our system, I guess you could call it, that was completely set up. Mm-hmm. You know, we were sort of done. We had done almost as much as we could do with that property. And now moving to Maine and we're starting over, which is very difficult in a way because all of the herb beds and all of the, everything is gone. And so we're completely starting over from the ground up. And I feel like we felt like that we had to catch up from 10 years mm-hmm. of hard work that we put in on our last house as quickly as possible and didn't really want to put in another 10 years of work in order to get back to the point that we were at. So Dalen has come on this spring, and he's going to stay with us, like I said, on and off through Thanksgiving and be out helping Susie around the the gardens and getting things set up. So we're super excited to have him, and you'll be hearing a tons more about him, I'm sure. And, you know, everybody around here seems to want him to come to their house too, so.
Seems like everybody needs a Dalen.
Yeah, but we have ours and we're not giving him any days off. So, and then finally, before we get into the pond discussion, just a technical note. We had some issues last week, as many of you realized. We were hosting our podcast through archive.org, which is, I won't go into what it is, but it's basically, it was a free service that we were using to host our podcast files, since we're getting a lot of downloads mm-hmm. every week, and it would have really put a hurt on the web host that we use, or the host, or the server that we use, because we do our own web hosting. But last week, archive.org decided to have 5 days of downtime for maintenance, they called it, and all of the files were unavailable, and that was when the last podcast published, which meant that iTunes didn't pick it up, which meant that Stitcher didn't pick it up, which meant that it wasn't available on the website during that time. And so we have decided to start using a third-party service to host our podcast files, which unfortunately is going to cost us money every month, but it will be 100% reliable, and it's a much better way to do it, because obviously if the show's not available, that's not good. Right. So we're going to go ahead and do that using a company called Libsyn. But the technical note is that if you didn't get last week's show in iTunes, we're actually going to republish it right before this show. We have to do it as a new post on the blog. I'm going to try to move the comments over to that one so we don't lose any, because and we're going to continue the book giveaway for another week.
Right.
So if you didn't get last week's show in iTunes or in Stitcher or whatever program you're using, it should be in the feed now, that you can go back and hit the button to manually download it. A lot of times when two episodes show up at once, it only downloads the latest one depending on your settings. So Brian's Geeky Corner is go back and download last week's show.
Right, because it was really great. An interview mm-hmm. with Hank Will, editor of Grit Magazine. Mm-hmm. So, how about his book he wrote called Plowing with Pigs?
Right. And you'll find out in that podcast how to get a free copy of the book signed.
Enter for a chance to win.
Yeah. And he and his wife are both going to sign it. And we're hoping to have Hank on future shows too, because mm-hmm. he is just you can tell by the interview that he is an absolute just treasure trove mm-hmm. of information in and regards to anything.
He's supposed to be at the Harvest Fest at
Monticello,
which we're planning on going to this fall, so we can actually meet him in person.
Yep. And more about that in the future, because we might be doing a Chiyotz run meetup at the Monticello right. Harvest Fest, so that'll be a lot of fun too. So anyway, so with all those notes out of the way, we want to get on to the main feature tonight. We're kind of taking a week off in a way where what do they call that when you...
Sabbatical?
Calling an audible in football. It shows you how much I watch football. We're calling an audible tonight. But we went a few weeks ago and we recorded another session at the Belfast Free Library that cost us $10 a year to be members of. And it's on pond building, which I know...
Pond building and maintenance, I think, mm-hmm. is the title.
Which I know might not be of interest to some of you. And if that's the case, then you can turn off the podcast right. once you are done hearing my voice.
But she gave a really interesting thing in the talk about how some people build ponds as for like fire. Mm-hmm. So you build them and you put in a special little hydrant kind of thing. Yeah. And then it's a good way to provide water for the local fire department for, depending on how close to the road you are, how close to other places for your home, farm, mm-hmm. and or maybe some other locations as well. So that's something I never even considered. We'd like to put in a little pond more as to increase the different kinds of areas we have here. Mm-hmm. I'd love to have a place to plant some water garden, like some water plants. You know, just kind of an area to have a little more diversity around, and something to kind of catch some of the rain runoff and filter it down into the ground, and, you know, somewhere for our ducks to splash around, that kind of thing. You know, nothing gigantic, but...
Yes, the following week we also went to a talk about rain gardens, which was a really interesting talk, but unfortunately we were unable to record it. That's how I wanted to say that. But rain gardens, the idea behind that is that if you have a lot of runoff on your property, it's better to for not only you and your property, but also for the water table itself, and also for
like
your
the
neighbors
of
and
the water and everything in general,
and for the community, because, you know, if you have all this runoff, it has to go somewhere, and usually that ends up in a creek, which then floods. So having a rain garden is basically like a catch basin almost that you then build up and plant into water-loving plants. So it kind of goes along with that. Now, some of the talk tonight, I will warn you, is a little bit visual. She went through a lot of slides, and she'll be, you'll hear some chuckling because she explains what how to build upon and how not to build upon, and then she'll show a slide, and it's definitely how not to. But I think that you'll be able to get the gist of it, and hopefully you'll be able to get something out of it as far as building ponds. And then we'll be back next week with a regular show discussing
some
interesting topic that we're not quite sure about yet. So hopefully you enjoy this pond. Oh, man. I really segued into that. Hopefully you enjoy this talk on ponds. I don't really have a clean segue. Here it is.
Thank you very much. I'm going to try my best to stand for you tonight, but I have to be up front. A month ago today, I decided to test bone structure strength, and it didn't make it. So I slipped on the ice and broke my leg in two places. And so as of yesterday, I got the walking cast, because before that, I didn't exactly know how I was going to do this. So the walking cast is very, very much appreciated at this very moment. So hopefully my strength holds out, but please, I tried not to sit, but I may have to. So please forgive me for that.
Oh, fixed it.
All right. Yeah, I know you want me to keep talking so you can tell. So as Brenda said, I'm an engineer out of the southern part of the state. We work for the Adams here with me as my chauffeur, and he also is an engineer with me out of the Lewiston office. We provide assistance for the Natural Resource Conservation Service, part of the USDA, and we used to be known as the Soil Conservation Service. Many of you probably know that name. We've been around since the early 1930s. Our focus is on natural resources, obviously. We're dealing with soil erosion, so we deal a lot with crop projects, nutrient management projects, more known as manure. We've gotten into irrigation. We've got a lot of different things. So this is a presentation that we provide through the districts, through the conservation districts, just to talk about ponds. We used to do a lot of construction of ponds. We're not doing that as much anymore, but we still have the knowledge that we like to share with the public. So we're going to start out. I have a few different PowerPoints to go through, and I'm going to start out with just an overview, and then I'm going to open it up to get some feedback from you folks. So, does everyone see that okay and
yes,
see past
can
me?
Can I just ask a question?
Sure.
Is this too dark or is this okay?
Great.
Okay.
Okay.
Wonderful.
We'll try to take
some. In the back of the room, there are handouts of some of the key points, not everything, but the key points that you'll need to hopefully take away with you. Anne, is that correct? Anne was saying you have the book that's available either in a CD format or in a printed paper. And a little later on, I'll talk about another book that you can get for $20 from the Extension Service, which is another good resource. We'll pass one around a little later on so you can take a peek. So if you want a pond, chances are you want to capture all these little guys, these little raindrops, and make something like this. So the first thing you need to do is determine the use or the need of your pond. What are you looking at doing with this pond? Are you, what's the size that you're thinking about? What's your location? What are the features? What do you expect to get out of this pond? Are you going to do an embankment or an excavated pond? And I'll be using those terms throughout. throughout the evening. Embankment would be something that's got a dam to it, a built-up end to it. You've got a sloping land, you've blocked off one end of it, and that's an embankment or a dammed pond. And an excavated pond or dugout pond, those are interchangeable words, and that's basically where you have a flat, wet type of a soil, and you just dig it out and have a hole with water in it, a big puddle. Mm-hmm. And what are the desired uses, and what are your priorities of those uses? Oh, and by the way, I'm sorry I didn't say, this is my first time doing it for this year, and I think my brain got left with my foot somewhere. But I'm a very casual speaker. If you see something or if I say something and it doesn't make sense, please give me a shout out. Don't feel like you need to wait to the end for a specific question at the end. I'll definitely have time to answer questions specific to some site you may be thinking about. So one of the uses you may be looking at doing is a fire protection pond, putting in a dry hydrant in front of this gentleman, get my pointer. There's a dry hydrant for your local fire departments to be able to hook onto. Whoops. You may be thinking about a fish pond. Maybe you want to grow trout, and as we can see jumping here, someone threw in some food and you got some trout. Maybe you're a contractor and you're going to do some development and there's a stormwater pond that you have to do to make DEP's rules fit, that you know about your runoff and controlling how much is leaving the site. Maybe you're looking at doing a wildlife pond. Here you have a pond with an island on it, so you have some wildlife protection areas. Maybe you're looking at doing a pond for recreational purposes, whether it's for your own or you have a campground or some type of recreational thing. You want to have a little beach area, a little dock, something like this. Maybe you have a golf course and you're trying to do something and improve your aesthetics. And then maybe you're just looking at a small backyard pond. I know this is a garden club. Maybe you've got a little aesthetic garden pond. And now here's one that the pond is a secondary use. They actually wanted to get to the backside to a woodlot back in, pardon me, my pointer's not working that great, back in through here. And so the dam or embankment is being used as a roadway to get from one side to the other. And out of this, they got a pond. Maybe you have agricultural domestic animals and you want to have a pond for that, or wildlife. One thing I want to warn you about using a pond for animals is where the animals can get into, they're also going to defecate and it's going to affect your water quality. It may be better off to have a pond that you have a pipeline out of, or a solar pump, something to that effect, that the animals don't have contact with the water but can still use the water as a drinking source. Maybe you're looking at using the pond for irrigation. And here's a pond that we built that our agency was involved in, and we were actually, I said earlier that we're involved a lot with manure storage. Well, we were making a clay-lined pond area to hold manure, and we needed the source of the clay to line it so you wouldn't have any leachate coming out of it. And so this was a natural site of clay, and we excavated it out, and in return, the landowner got the clay for the manure pit and got a pond on top of that. So once you determine your pond use, you need to look at choosing your site. And the best way to do that is have something in mind and then research your soils through the soil survey and determine what your water source is, and then determine what type of pond it's going to be based off of all this data that you pulled together. Now, one thing I wanted to say about when you're choosing your pond source, or pond use, I should say, is that you don't want to say, I want my pond for irrigation and fire protection, because I'll guarantee that Murphy will come along, and in the year that's been the driest year and you've used all your water for irrigation is when your barn's going to burn and you really wish you had that water for fire protection. So make sure that your uses are compatible. Same thing, you don't want to have it be an irrigation pond and a trout pond, because you're going to be sucking that water down, it's going to turn to warm water, and the fish aren't going to have the water to live in. Now, if you want to have it as a fire protection pond and a aesthetic pond, or animal use pond, that will go well together. You know, so you can have multiple uses, but make sure you realize, what's my priority use? Is it irrigation? Is it fire protection? And make sure they're not going to conflict with each other. So I talked about researching the soils. This is very important, because you may think you have the best spot for a pond, but it may be that you're just ponding water at the surface because it's gotten compacted, and you go down 2 feet and you're into a sandy soil. The first way to do that is looking at the soil surveys. And here you got one that each county has it. There's Waldo County, Kennebec. All the different counties have these paper surveys. You can get them at any of the NRCS offices. In this electronic day and age, we also have it available online with the Web Soil Survey. And in the handouts gives you the address to that, or you can just Google or search for Web Soil Survey. You go in there. You put in your address, and it'll pull up a map of where you are. Then you're going to go in and make what they call an area of interest, and you kind of make a little circle of, yep, this is my property, this is where I'm interested, and it'll pull up all the soils information, as you can see it over here, and then it goes ahead and it describes those soils. And so anything that's got this letter, it's kind of showing off the screen, but the first one is AAB, is an Adam soil, which means it's a sandy soil. Probably not the best place for a pond because it's going to be a well-draining sand. So this would go through and it tells you what kind of soil you have on your property, and then you can also go through and look at those properties, soil properties, as in characteristics, and see what an Adam soil really can do for you and whether it's going to have good water ponding characteristics. So this is a very helpful tool. It kind of makes you look at the site, because there's a lot of times you can get a hard pan or a surface water that's ponding, but then come August you have a dry hole. And we'll look at that a little bit later on.
Does the website explain those Adams and Agawam and Belgrade and Chatham?
Yes, it goes through and it explains every one of those. The book does, as well as the website. You can click on that. And there's some, but this isn't showing you. I don't know if I have another one. No, I don't. They has a couple of tabs across the top that'll call it soil profiles and soil characteristics, and it'll give you a write-up, and it'll also give you engineering properties, such as does it hold water, how often does it flood, would it have a perched water table, all this is information on it. I think it's a really nicely set up website, and it'll talk you through all those things. A lot of times you can just hover over the names, and it'll tell you some stuff about it as well. And what this is right here is it's saying of this area that it's hard to see on this, but that area that I've highlighted out with the gold is where my area of interest, and it tells me that 22 acres of that was at Adams up top, and 48 is the Adams at a steeper slope, and it tells you how much of your land is underneath that. This is not helpful for so many things, not just for pond building. This is if you're doing anything of working the lands or wanting to develop the land for house lots or, like I said, agriculture use, anything that you're trying to do. Maybe you think that you have a good source of gravel on your property and you want to become, the next stone gravel pit, So you could look at all that kind of stuff on this site and see what your property has to offer you. Or if you're looking at purchasing property, it lets you kind of snoop at it. The one thing about the soil survey is it's accurate to about a 3-acre size. So a lot of times you're just looking at doing a half-acre pond and you may have what we call a soil inclusion, a little wet area that didn't get mapped. Because you have to remember, this is literally done by folks from the Soil Conservation Service walking the land and doing random sampling in different places. So again, it's got about a 3-acre accuracy. There you go. So the best thing to do is test pit at your thought about location. And as they say in the real estate business, location, location, location. Well, the one thing I want you to walk out of here tonight with, if you're looking at doing a pond, is test pit, test pit, test pit. It's very cheap to either get a soil auger and do a look like that, or get a backhoe. This is an old backhoe. We get a backhoe and dig a hole, or an excavator, and have them come in for a day or a couple hours and dig a hole and see what you have underneath the ground, what's hidden underneath there. That way you know what you're dealing with. What are you going to hit? They're going to start digging, and it's peppered with rocks and boulders, and it's going to be tough digging. Am I going to go down 2 feet and hit ledge? Is it a great bubbling, sandy, gravelly aquifer that I'm into? What's going on? And when you test pit, sit there and be aware what your use of this pond is going to be. If you want to be a deep trout pond, you're going to want to have a depth of about 10 feet deep, then make sure you test pit to 10 to 12 feet deep. If you're saying, nope, I just want a shallow pond, I want the wildlife to be able to come, I want it to kind of be marshy, overgrown, and not do anything much more than 2-3 feet deep, there's no reason to test pit any deeper than 2-4 feet deep. So keep that in mind. Make sure your test pit's at least as deep as what you're looking to have your pond be. Now here's I showed earlier the gentleman doing the auger. And this is a soil you're going to pull out through it. Now this soil is a nice, rich, growing type of soil, but not really the best you want for a pond because it's not really a tacky, sticky type of soil. It's pretty porous. The water's going to be able to go right through it. This one, you see how it ribbons between this gentleman's fingers? You can see its stickiness, the clay, the silty side of it. That's what you're looking for more for a ceiling type of a pond to be tight and hold your water for you. And the reason I keep harping about those locations and the test pitting and finding out what your soils are doing for you, here's a prime example. Here's a pond that was dug where this gentleman standing is on ledge, and it's draining out on them. And a lot of folks will say, well, geez, you know, if I have ledge, does that mean I might have a spring coming up through there and that could be my water source? Yeah, and you might win the lottery tomorrow too. It's it's one of those catch-22s. Your ledge can work two ways on you. That fractures in the ledge may be your source of water and it may be your drain hole. How much of a gambler are you? You know, I'd hate to have a few days of an excavator out there digging this, shaping this whole thing in to have this be what's in my backyard, a meteor crater.
So what's his solution? or he does what?
They could try putting a liner into it.
That's the only thing.
Brenda, can I ask for the lights to go up for just a minute? Thank you. Walk this way. The liners, and we'll pass around because everybody likes show and tells and hands-on stuff. You can go real fancy on liners if you're going for a pond. This is a high-density polyethylene, or HDPE, you hear people. And it's the same stuff that black corrugated culvert's made out of. And that shows how they heat seal the pieces together. There's a few of those that can pass around to different thicknesses. And that's something you can line the pond with. However, it's not a cheap thing to do. And what you have to do is you have to make sure you have a drain underneath, because you don't want the water to be able to come in underneath it, because it would bubble it up and look like your pool when you close it off in the winter, you know, the big hump in the middle. that's something to consider. That's what they do for like landfills. It's the way we would do with the manure storage site if we can't do something out of concrete or out of a natural soil. Then there's these other products that are what they call impregnated with bentonite clay in between the fibers. And I've got them in the Ziplocs because they'll sift, but feel free to open them and take a peek inside if you'd like. And there's a few different versions of them, but it says right on the top. I'm not endorsing any of these products. It's just that who sends me free samples? And then here's another one with the liner and the clay all mixed in on that. So just something to look about, different things to do. Definitely an option. It jacks the price of your pond up to do something like that. We're lucky here in Maine. There's a lot of places, if your land doesn't have clay or silty, heavy clay material, maybe someone in the, you know, within a 5-10 mile radius may have some, and you can line your own pond just by bringing in material and what they call bathtub lining it, really dumping it in and having the excavators just keep walking it up the sides and smearing it on the inside of your pond, and that'll help plug it. So, and if you do that, you don't have to worry about a perimeter drain because now you've plugged it from both directions. So that's always an option to do with a pond. Does that help?
I've been told that I've got a cracked ledge everywhere. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and it's nothing you can do. Just give up.
So you have a pond. It's,
no.
Oh, but I mean, so I mean the other, yeah, and you, it may be that water comes in on it. It's just one of those things you don't know. And one of the ways, if that's your concern, is to consider again that test pinning. It's an expense, but a minor one, to go in there, dig a hole, see what depth you can get to, and then see if that hole fills with water and stays full of water. And when you dig those holes, don't do it right now, because pretty much everything will fill with water. You want to be doing that July, August, during your dry time, to see, okay, if I can hold water now, I can hold water any day. Thank you on the light. Oh, yes?
Do you need a permit to do a test pit?
Not to do a test pit, no, because it's a small enough area of disturbance, because you're allowed to disturb under a tenth of an acre of wetland, if you're concerned that you're in a wetland, without permits or anything like that. Good question, and we'll get to permitting a little bit later. I try to stay out of that, but I'll give you enough just to skim coat it. So we talked a little bit about the soil side of things. Let's determine the potential water source. Now, your water source, as I talked about a little bit earlier, could be a couple of different things. One could be that it's the groundwater itself, just filling in from the soils around it if you're in a wet area. And the other could be the watershed coming down through. And that's what I'm trying to illustrate here, is that you have this hillside's all draining down. Let's say I'm putting the pond down here. Everything up and through here is going to drain down into that pond area. Chances are you're not going to have that big of an area. Maybe it's going to be something more like this backyard sloping in, and you're going to capture this material here, this water here. You brought up regulations here in my context. Your local code enforcement officer is someone to keep on board, because, as you know, towns are getting more and different regulations because of shoreland as I said before, I'm out of Lewiston, so I talk about the south. Like if you're in the Saco River corridor, you have different restrictions. I'm not sure what your any sensitive watersheds around here, but those things to keep in mind. Check with your town ordinances, shoreline zoning, dig safe. Make sure you check with dig safe. That could be a permit issue. And that would be up to your between you and your contractor to make sure that that site's been dig safe, to make sure you don't have any fiber optic lines in the area. Kind of expensive at that time. And then contact DEP about permits. Their rules are a changing thing, and I'm not going to say one way or the other about whether you are or not going to be, but I will hit on some of the things that I'll tell you that I'm not going to let you do. If you look at a topographic map and the water that you're wanting to dam off is a blue line on the topo map, you're not going to be able to do it. It's pretty straightforward. They don't want to dam up any waters of the state of Maine. So if it's a blue line, a flowing water, they want to make sure that that stays open. In some situations, they'll let you do something on the floodplain, being 25, 50, maybe 75 feet. It varies based off the shoreline zone of it, the size of the stream. And you could do a pond off on the side of it. So sometimes that's an option because you can kind of feed off that same groundwater but not be impeding the flows. Your best bet, the easiest things to get through permitting right now are your dugout ponds where you're just disturbing a small wetland type area and not damming up a flowing stream. Okay, does that, like I said, I don't want to speak on, your best bet to do on those things is one of those that it's better to ask permission than beg forgiveness. And that you can call these folks, you can say, hey, you call up to DEP, you say, I've got this site, this is the town that I'm in, I'm interested in doing a pond, can you do a site visit? They'll come out, they'll look at the site, and they'll say, you can't do this, but you can do that. And so that's the best way to go about it, because you may not be able to do exactly what you had in mind, but they can give you a variation, or they could say, you can do this, but you need to do a full-blown permit, but if you verify it to vary it to such and such, you can get by with a permit by rule or no permits at all. So it's one of those things that's a lot easier to see what they can give you for options ahead of time, as opposed to trying to straighten things out afterwards. Yes?
Is there a charge for that type of visit?
No. That's already been charged. It's called your local taxes. It's kind of like me speaking tonight. It makes you feel better you're getting something out of your taxes. So so here's a pond. The biggest thing here is after you've got your pond all built, you're happy with it, things are looking great, just sit back and enjoy it. So I'm going to take a little break from the PowerPoints and ask if I have the lights up again. Thank you. Ask for some feedback from you folks. I've got a bunch of these opened up here. Yeah. What kind of ponds, you all came here for a pond session, I'm sure you had something in mind. What did you have in mind for a pond? How many people here think that they're going to do an excavated dugout type pond?
Maybe.
How many think that they were going to put up an embankment pond, block off a flow, and have a big berm? Oh, you got a mix of everything. How many people already have a pond and they're having problems and they have questions? Look at that. I can't tailor my talk at all. I've got a third to each of you. Okay. And how many came because they heard there was going to be good snacks? There you go. Okay, so I have, as you saw, I have a few different PowerPoints opened up. And one focuses just on the excavated ponds. So those of you that are here for embankment ponds, sit back and you learn something a little different. Then we'll go through embankment ponds. And then we'll talk about bad things, because it's always important to learn from other people's mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. And then we'll follow up with a little bit on maintenance. Sound good?
Yeah.
Okay. I do this because sometimes there's no one for embankments, and so I don't bother with that. Yes, ma'am?
One other thing, if you have any resources as far as who can do one for us, if we were to hire somebody, and I mean, I know there's no soil conservation money anymore, but is there any other kind of money available?
It depends on, good question. I'm having mouse issues. It depends on about money being available. If you are looking at doing it for irrigation, the state of Maine has some money through the Maine Department of Agriculture for irrigation if you're trying to do a crop, vegetables, whatever. I know there's some money there. There's a little bit through our agency, not a whole lot, and there's some regs with that. But if you're looking at it for fire ponds, sometimes your local fire departments are supportive of that. They can try to get some grants if there's nothing in their area. And they're like, you know, if you let us use your fire pond for this whole neighborhood, then a lot of times they can help you out. If you're looking at it for just aesthetics, I don't think there's a whole lot available. As far as contractors, that's a very good question. Mr. Larrabee, are you still in business? he's done a lot of work for the state, for our agency, so I try not to endorse just one person, but he's the only person I know in this area because I don't cover this area anymore. I used to. But any local contractor that usually you do, well, it depends what size you're going for, but a lot of times it's your smaller contractors that are going to be potentially your best deal for something like this. But the biggest thing is to check with them for references. Say, hey, have you built ponds before? And if they're like, well, no, really, all I've ever done is was put in curbing and sidewalk, well, that may not be the person that you want for this job. And so you want to have someone that's got familiarity with this. And as we go through some of these pitches, you'll see what they, you may want to have them to have for equipment. And ask them for references. And if they say, yeah, I built a pond for, you know, John Doe down the street, then you can go down and say, hey, John, how's your pond? Were you happy with it? That kind of a thing. So that would be, you know, and word of mouth, as you know, is the best advertisement. So.
Mr. Larrabee did my pond and he did a great job.
There you go.
He had all kinds of additional things to add to, you know, suggestions that I would never have thought of.
Yep, there you go. So there's a good endorsement and you can tip her at the door, right?
While you're bringing my name up here, one thing I want to caution everybody on digging a pond is, if there's any runoff to come into that pond, what kind of runoff it is. Because if you've got a nice lawn on one side of a small pond and you fertilize it heavy, you can ruin that pond.
Yeah. Perfect, yeah.
Be real careful. You can put ditches around a pond, put diversions in, and you keep out your surface water waiting to track.
But yeah. And that's
I really caution you. And the other thing is if you've got a farmer up the road from you and there's water coming across his fields and you want to dig a pond that's going to be in that runoff, you could create him a lot of problems. So you want to be aware of where you are and what's going on around you.
Yeah, very good points. Thank you. And when I get into pond maintenance, I have actually some pictures of the effects of potentially of the lawns being too close and pros and cons of all that. So thank you. So we talked a little bit about your process, and this is, again, excavated or dugout pond. Use those words interchangeably. You have the test pit to your pond depth. Are you bedrock free? And does it hold water? And you answer those questions. If it's no, then you need to consider a new site or go to the expense of the liners if you really want to go that direction. And if you do have it, then you obtain the necessary permits, get your contractor, and go ahead and dig. An excavated pond is pretty straightforward. In your handouts that were in the back of the table, there's this pond table. Excuse me. What this is especially helpful if you're trying to do it for fire protection, because they want to have so many gallons below ice level, so this would help kind of figure that amount out. Or if you're using it for irrigation, how much water you would get out of the pond. So how this table works is you have a pond that's, say, it's 50 feet wide by 100 feet long, and it's 8 feet deep. So right there, that number says 870 cubic yards of soil that would have to come out. So when you're dealing with your I should leave this out too. The side slopes are at a 2-to-1 slope. And what that means is for every 2 feet horizontal, you drop 1 foot. So if this pond's 8 feet deep, from the top to the bottom is a 16, if you put a straight line and kind of made a triangle out of it, you'd be 8 feet deep and 16 feet of a horizontal distance to get to the bottom. Does that make sense? So you don't want your side slopes any steeper than that, because the soil's not going to hold. It's going to calve and fall on you. If you want to have this as a place to come in and swim, obviously you're going to make it a lot flatter than that, because you won't be able to climb out of this.
But your 2-to-1 slope is to keep the grass from growing in your
pond. Yes, exactly.
It'll weed in on you if you don't have it 2-to-1.
That's right, because if you have a gentle shelf, then that's when you're going to get your cattails. Your cattails and your other types of weeds like to be somewhere between 12 to 24 inches of water depth. And so that's why a lot of times you'll see that ring of cattails around the edge, because of that. So the steeper your sides, the smaller the areas that ring can form. If you make it flatter, you can't. Now, some other things to think about is, again, I've mentioned swimming for the people, but if you're looking at this as a wildlife pond, you want to have the deer and coons and everything else kind of come and hang out at the edge and drink and, you know, be very aesthetically wildlife friendly that way. Think about it. I'm a deer. I'm not going to come and look into this thing that drops right off and try to balance on this 2-to-1 slope. They're going to want something that has a gentle slope that they have sheer footing, and you may want to have an area that's only a couple of feet deep. Yes, it's going to be more prone to the weed problem, but it's also going to be more friendly to the critters. Back to the table. The other number underneath there in that same scenario is 176, and that 176 is 176,000 gallons, so that's how much water that pond would hold. Okay? So again, this is in your handouts, and it just kind of gives you something to look at, to think about what your size is. The big number, again, if you are in a wetland type of an area, soggy boggy, the sedges, that kind of a thing, and it's deemed wetland, the magic number from the Corps is a tenth of an acre. If you disturb something that's more than a tenth of an acre, which is 4,356 square feet, or basically an easy way to do it, it's about 40 by 100, that then you're going to be looking at potentially needing some permitting regulations. And when I say disturb, that doesn't just include the dugout hole from the pond, but then if you are making any kind of like a little embankment, or if you're taking the spoil, the material you take out of there, you need to take that off-site and not disturb it. So disturbing means either taking away soil or adding soil. Construction checklist for an excavated pond. You want to install erosion control structures. What I'm talking about here is silt fence or bark berms to make sure there's any works going on. If there's a big rain event that comes about, it's not going to take any of the soil and wash it away. And especially around wherever you take this material to stockpile it. You want to determine where the low point is or the outlet of your pond. And, and we haven't talked much about outlets as we kind of go through this. But every pond needs to have some type of an outlet. Now, if you have a huge watershed, 100 acres coming down through, and really you're damming up a large area, then you need to have quite an outlet structure. And we'll talk about that when we get into embankments. And the excavated, you often don't have a lot of area that's feeding into it. It's just whatever falls on it. But stop and think. When you have hurricane come through and we have 5 inches of rain and it falls into that pond, you have 5 inches of rain, so where's it got to go? So you always have to have a little bit of an overflow area. And stake out where this pond's going to be, any small berm, because sometimes, as we know, the site's not going to be a perfectly flat site. You're going to have a little bit of a slope to it. So even if you have a berm that's like my waist high or lower, that's still considered an excavated or dugout pond. This is just a little berm on the low side. I consider an embankment pond when it's 6 feet or higher. Rule of thumb. And then excavate the material out from working from the inside to the outside edge. Now, so you want to dig the depth to the depth that you determine through your test pitting and what you want to use it for. You want to shape that inlet and rock it as necessary. And I've got pictures because words are boring, and I got pictures that'll make more sense of this. And then seed and mulch any disturbed areas. Remove that stockpile material to an acceptable area, meaning not filling a wetland. And then remove your erosion control products and protection as needed when things are all seeded and stable. So let's kind of do a walkthrough because, like I said, words are boring. I shouldn't say that in the library, should I? So here's the site that we're looking at preparing for a pond. It's been cut over. And we're meeting with a contractor talking about what we're looking at doing. This was done... Mr. Larrabee could probably attest to this. It was done quite a while ago. And so this was using a dozer. A lot of places now use excavators. And then they're just grubbing off the topsoil, getting all that rich, loamy, organic material off to the side. And then they start shaping and cutting in to make in the pond site. Here they are checking grades, making sure they're getting to the depth that they want. They're kind of getting the whole site leveled out, what they want it shaped as. As you can see here, it's a lot flatter. They obviously want to have a more gentle pond in this situation. Here's one that, a little more recent picture. This was in a wet, sandy soil. So even though it says it's a sand, it doesn't mean that's completely off the radar. This was a very wet sand. It wasn't the Adams, it was a Naumburg sand. And the high water table, just water's just running through, kind of almost attached to an aquifer. And so in this situation, they used the excavator, and he just started at the edge and just kept baling his material out. And then this piece in through here is where the spillway is going to be to shape out. You'll see that in a minute. So here's his edges. This one's going to be used for irrigation. So we are trying to keep our weeds and everything. We're not concerned about wildlife, so we have the steep sides to it. And one thing I want to point out in this picture, a lot of times folks talk about soils, and it's like, oh, it's that gray soil. It's got to be that good clay. Color and gray color and clay aren't necessarily go hand in hand. The gray color is because it's void of oxygen. And so it's got that gray color. It hasn't had oxygen. If it has oxygen into it, it has more of a reddish color like this. This is actually where iron's kind of been leached out of it. So it's the upper area of the water table comes and goes and comes and goes. And so it's got that reddish color. But down in here, it's constantly in water, so it's void of oxygen, thus making it this gray color. So that, even though it's gray and you want to say immediately, oh, it's a silt clay, it's not. That's all sand. It's just void of oxygen. So keep that in mind as you're, it's the silt clay, the sand, it all has to do with how big the particles are. So here we are working that pond. He's shaping it out. Obviously, it's a work in progress. These sides need to be made flatter. Here's another one. I threw this one in. This is, again, done for irrigation. And it's a small pond, but you see you didn't even have to have a berm. It was a dead flat site. They just bermed, you know, just dug this hole, left it right there. But what's one of the things that you don't like about this pond?
Ugly.
It's ugly. It has, this looks like an engineer designed it with straight lines, doesn't it? I had nothing to do with it, honestly. But yes, that's exactly the thing. One of the things that you're going to really want to focus on is getting a shape to make it aesthetically pleasing. You're obtaining the same thing as that pond I just showed you, but it's got a little bit more character to it. So think about that too, and work with your contractor about that. And you know, you have a contract. Lots of contractors can dig a square hole in the ground, but someone needs to take it that next step and make it a little bit more artistic. Then the other thing is too, we talked about the spoil of the stock material, and here's one. Don't do this, leaving it on the site in big piles. Kind of landscape it, spread it around if you're not in a wetland, or again, take it off site. If you can be reused, like I had that clay site, you know, can you use it for something else? So now I'm back to that sand pond that I was talking about, and they've got it all shaped in. Excuse me. And you see right here on this side, you can see how it's been cut down, and that is where the overflow is going to be. Because again, there's really no watershed that's feeding this, but when you do have snow melt, rain, a rain event, water's got to leave this site if they haven't been pumping it down for irrigation, and it's going to go out the spillway right through here. The other thing to look at when you get back into here, because we said, well, there's not going to be much coming in from the surface. Oh, well, right here from the roadway that I'm literally standing on for this photo, the water came down the roadway and ran in, and so it gullied this out. So those are things to look at, because especially if you're going for your pond for fisheries or aesthetics, you don't want to have it silted up all the time, or even with irrigation because you want to plug up your filters. You don't want it to be silted up with sediment being moved in from your inlet. So you want things to be stable. The lady spoke about the pond that Mr. Larrabee built, and these might have been some of the things that he added. We won't talk about the pipe just yet, but they might put stones in the center if you're looking at for fish habitat, because that gives the fish shelter, shade, and protection from predators. You may do islands. We talked about that a little bit in my overview. And then this is that island 1 year later. You can see that the tall stuff here is they put in an annual rye just to get a good seed catch. You can see the island. And then this is several years in the future. You can see they got a wood duck box out there. And it's really grown up and around it and very natural looking. Okay, I've talked a little bit about outlets. Let's get into the nitty-gritty about it. Rock spillways is your best outlet. Here is that darn engineer again with her perfectly symmetrical drawings and stuff. But what you want to have is a stone. You can sometimes do it out of grass, except if you have a constant seep going on. Let's say you hit a little bit of a spring, you have constant water running out of it. It's hard for that grass to establish, and so you may have some erosion problems. So stone, I'm a big fan of stone. So a little stone spillway is a real nice way to go, and going underneath it with either gravel or geotextile. And excuse me a minute. I have here two samples, and you'll feel the difference between the two. I'll start two on this side. There's two different types. One is a woven, and it kind of looks like a plastic burlap bag, best way to describe it in my book. And you have the other one, which looks like a big piece of felt. And this is called woven geotextile. It makes sense. It looks like it's woven. This is non-woven or needle punch geotextile. And a lot of times you're using this instead of a gravel. And what's the beautiful thing about these is when you have water flowing over, and you've got rock in here, and the water's flowing over, we'll talk about this one first, water has a suction ability as it's going across the top of things, and it's going to suck up your fines. And so if you have this kind of a silty material, soil underneath, it's going to pull that up through your stones, and you don't really want that. And so what this fabric does is it keeps that from happening. I tend to do food analogies, so bear with me. It's kind of like a cake. It keeps your frosting. This is like the frosting in your double layer cake, and keeps the two pieces of cake from going together. That's what this does. A lot of times you'll see folks that try to use the woven. This reminds you of silt fencing, and it has its place. It works good underneath roads and that kind of thing because it has structural strength. This, if I was feeling really strong, I could deform it and stretch it out. This, I can't. But the problem with this is if you have any kind of slope and you stack rocks on it, it's slippery when wet, and so everything's going to just slide off of it. So that's something to keep in mind of what's the best material to use.
When did you change the design to have a two-way instead of a flat one. I was trying the old days.
Yeah. No one really builds them that way anyways. It's and in the small, you're 100% right, Clayton, on the bigger spillways. It should be the flat emergency spillways. You can get away with this when you have the smaller ones. And what you'll see in the pictures in a minute is actually I leave it flat when it's leaving the pond. And then as it's starting to shape and go down, it's got the curve to it. So here's one that we did a few years ago in Lincoln, Knox or Lincoln County. Ulna. And so here's the pond, and right here is where it's leaving. And just like Clayton was saying, this part we're actually leaving grass because it's really flat. The water's not moving very quickly through this section, and so this is the flat spillway. What we're trying to do is take that water and get it in a nice flat. We don't want it to get in the one concentrated area. We want a nice level plane leaving the site, and then it comes out and it falls into the stone material here. And the water's flowing through here. It's just in the stones. You can't see it. And then it's at the same pond. We've turned the corner and we've gone down, and it's running down into the natural runoff area. This is actually rebuilt. This is another one, and again, it goes back to what Clayton was just saying. We have a control section here of the grass, and that's done for a couple of reasons. One is, again, to maintain that even flow going out, and then it's going to go through the stone. The other reason is, I'm going to go back for just a second. No, maybe I'm not. If I had this being at the edge of my pond level, all that my pond's going to drop down and the water's going to always go out through the stone and the gravel and that kind of thing. But if I leave it so I have this clay-heavy soil berm, that's now becoming my control. That's the edge of my bowl, so my water can't leave my pond bowl. And then it works over that, then it falls down into the rock. If I had the rock go right to the edge, then it's going to work through that rock. Does that make sense? And then this is that same pond I just showed. Here's that grass control, and then it's just shape. And so here's where you're starting to get more of that parabolic shape. Does that make sense, Clayton? Mm-hmm. Does that agree with more of what you were taught?
Well, we used to come out in the pond level.
Yeah.
We had to be 20 feet long level.
Yeah.
And even the ones that had a 3-foot pipe that would run full through it, it didn't wash out because it was dead in the water and it flattened it out.
And you're going to see that when we get into the embankment ones. Again, these have got such small watersheds to it, you don't need to go quite that far. But with the embankment ones, you're right on the money. And here's one. It's not the best look. It shows you where that spillway is, but you can see that the water is going to just build up to here and then work its way through. But the other reason I threw this in is it ties right into what Clayton was talking about earlier. Here's your weed line from that. It came in with a little bit of a shelf, and this is going to be prone to cattails and weeds through here. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's just something that you need to pick and choose. Is that something you want? Some folks love the cattails because it's great a habitat for red-winged blackbird and other songbirds. Yes, sir.
My pond, I found it. It's better if I lower the level in the winter.
Yeah.
Just because it pushed through, pushed hard. But what do you do with that kind of? I'm just trying. I guess I'm thinking you build that flow for where you want it in the winter, and then you. And I would just top it in to keep it higher in the summer. Is that what you're...
You could try to build a, what do I call it, like a flashboard type of a structure for the summer. The other way to do it is if you want it low in the winter is just take a day or two of renting a mudsucker pump and pumping it down. And then it would, you know, pump it down when you want it pumped down in the fall and then let it fill up with your spring runoff and be back up to where you want it. That may be easier than the flashboards. The flashboards would be, or some type of a temporary berm structure for the summertime, may become a maintenance hassle. Mm-hmm. One of the nice things to do with lowering the water like that is it does help flush your pond. If you have a low flush rate, it helps make sure you're not getting nutrient buildups in your pond. It also helps discourage potentially unwanted wildlife such as weasels because and otters because they're going to want to try and form their homes right along that water's line. And so you bring it down in the fall, but then it comes back up and they'd be underwater and they're not going to be happy. So that helps discourage that kind of critters. I mentioned this a little earlier when I was handing out my geotextile samples, but here's what I was talking about. The flow as it goes across is like an airplane wing. It has a lift power. So if it was going across through here, it's going to lift up those fines through the stones. But if you put the fabric down, the non-woven, the felty stuff, it's going to keep those your soils from being pulled up through. And here's an example of one that wasn't a big enough spillway. It's washed itself out. You can see they had little pretty rock walls on the side, and it's just the rocks were too small. They couldn't take the flow of the water. They didn't have any good base underneath them, and it was just too skinny and small of an area. Here's one. This is actually not a pond outlet, but it shows it's a road ditch. But it shows you want your rocks to being a little bit of a varying size, but not to this extreme. Because, I mean, you've got little tiny stuff here, then you have huge rocks, and it should be kind of a mix of sizes. It varies in what you have for flows, but commonly looking at something that's a 4 to 6 to 8 inch size rock in that range, commonly. And one of the reasons this is a problem is, okay, let's say you have water coming down through here. It gets to this one. Well, this one, it can't really get itself around, so it's going to start, it's not using that full channel. It's going to be kind of weaving its way through and narrowing up where the flow is. One of my analogies is water is like teenagers. One of them, one droplet of water, one teenager is not really a big problem. You get a group of them together, you don't know how that's going to go. The same thing with water. Water works, it has a lot of power in numbers.
I had a quick question about sure. the spillway. Is there a formula that goes with the width, length, depth of the spillway as dictated by the size of the pond, or is it pretty generic?
No, that's a wonderful question, and it's a good good segue for me. Ann had spoke earlier about those, if you didn't get a CD or one of the printed out books, that you can get new copies. And a lot of this is spelled out in that pond planning design and construction book that our agency puts out with the farm pond scene on it. I got a couple of them over here. I'm sorry, I keep doing that light thing. This is what it was when they used to have it in print, and so you're getting the paper copy or the CD copy of it. And this goes through, it has something it talks about if you're doing your watershed, it talks about some of that spacing. Some of those pictures, like the ones I said, don't do this and do that for the shaping and all that, that's all taken right from this book. So this is a good reference of some particular sizing. And while we stop, the other good reference, and I have one, this is the districts I can pass around. This is the one the Extension Service has available, and it's a pretty good copycat of ours. And it has actually more in here on some maintenance stuff than ours does. It talks about, and we'll talk about it a little later on, but using different things like barley or lime or different things to help control algae issues, that kind of stuff. This isn't like an infomercial sales pitch or anything, but this is a good source, and it's $20, and I think, Kim, you said the district could loan theirs out or get them for folks, an extension.
I think if there's enough people interested, you could let Ann know once that gets passed around. We've got a county who would like to get one, and I'll contact the university and see if maybe they'd give us a discount for
group pitches. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's a tan one. It's called the Pond Guide Handbook, I think. Is that right?
The
Pond Guide Book.
That she held up first. If you let Ann know also, then I'll make sure to make some copies at the office and get them to Ann, and then she'll pass them out and get them to you folks.
And if you guys...
There's a sign-up sheet in the back, yes. And if you would prefer it on disk, just put the disk and not the paper copy. So, whatever.
And this... These books have been around for a long time. Yeah, this one was done when it was the Soil Conservation Service, and then this is when we reprinted it as a Natural Resource Conservation Service. And I'll tell you what the difference is. This one's got cows in the field in the back. This one does not. Besides that, everything on the inside is the same. Why they changed that in the picture, I have no idea. they must have thought the cows sent a bad water quality message or something. I don't know. Thanks, Brenda. So go through a little bit of construction techniques. This is that stone outlet I showed a few minutes ago, and we ran that the non-woven geotextile right up through that trench, and we stopped it here, and you see how we got a nice mix of stones, a little bit bigger, but a bunch of different sizes, and this was quite a steep slope, so it was a little bit bigger than what I just said of the 4 to 6 size. And then we shelved it up, and we left from this pink stake, we left this natural sod, so that's still holding the pond back as is. Ignore that pipe that's just thrown there. But this is how they shelved it, and then they put that rock right up into here, and so that's that interface. And so that geotextile wraps right up along this face, almost like tucking a sheet in is the best way to think of it. And then again, this is just a different camera angle, but you can see how it blends right up in and fits into the site. A little closer than the water. You can see it's coming right at me, and then it's just running down through the rocks. Anything as a question right now on the excavated ponds?
I noticed you had the sides pretty steep on that spillway right at the upper end.
I did.
Well, that picture showed it. You didn't. The picture showed it pretty steep. Pretty hard to hold the rocks on something like
that. And that was a pond that was pre-existing, and it was, all respect to the landowner, they've had the pond and they tried to fix it themselves and they tried to do concrete patches to it, like they were getting some gulling and eroding out, and so they were putting in little concrete strips and stuff, and it just wasn't working, and it kept getting a deeper and deeper gully going down through there. So this isn't how I would build it, this is how I was saving it. So yes, it was pretty steep on the sides, and I didn't have anything to do with it. It fell into the Sheepscot watershed, and as you folks probably know from this area, it's, you know, a watershed of high concern. We were getting a lot of sediment from that thing continually cutting, and so our agency was involved to stop that erosion source. He's keeping me on my toes tonight. That's good. So an embankment pond. Now, this is an embankment pond. I'm really hoping that you're not here for this because it's a little outside the scale of this class. And this is a concrete one, a little outside the scale too. This is probably a little bit more what you're looking at. Again, the pond is on this side where the trees are. We'll talk about trees being a bad thing in a minute. But just a nice earth berm. It could be, like I showed before, it could be a road. It could be a multi-purpose to it. So here's a little flow chart to go along with this. Again, you're going to do the test pitting. It'll sound like a broken record here. Test pit, test pit. Are you bedrock free? Does it hold water? If it's no, you need to consider a new site. Or again, look at your liners if you really want to go that direction. If it does hold water, then you can keep going this way. And we've added a new one here, suitable soil available for the dam. So if you're going to be taking soil out of the site and you know, kind of doing a cut, stealing some of it from the natural landscape to make the dam, you know, cut and fill. Is this going to be good stuff? Well, it might be kind of bouldery. Maybe it's really full of organics and you can't use it. So you may need to come in with a tighter soil material, which is again going to drive the cost up, because now you got to take the soil you're taking out to make a nice pond, take it away, and then bring in good tight stuff to make the dam. So that's something to think about. We'll go a little bit more detail about how to create that embankment. Then you have the spillways, we'll talk a little bit more about that, because if you're doing an embankment pond, chances are you've got a larger watershed than just your backyard that's draining into it, and you're going to have quite a bit of flow, and you may look at having to have both a pipe and a grass or emergency spillway like we were talking about earlier. And again, we have the pits and then permits and then go ahead and construct. So here, I'm going to walk her up here because I do better with my hand than the pointer. So this line right here is your natural ground line. That's what the ground is before you start anything. This piece right here is probably one of the most important parts of your dam. And this is called the core trench or the key or key trench. You know how construction is. Everyone's got about 16 different ways to say the same thing. And what this does is it locks your dam in. Now, I know that sounds funny. Why am I locking my dam in? Well, you need to because water, again, it's like the teenagers. And also, water is going to take the path of least resistance. Water is lazy. So you've got all your water in your pond built up here, and you have this natural soil right here. And so that water is going to go, oh, I can flow right through that natural soil, right through this line, and leave the site, and you've got a leak. But if you take and you cut this down, and you cut a trapezoidal gouge right out, usually it says 4 feet. That's usually the minimum. Usually it's 6 feet or 8 feet because it's your dozer blade width. And cut this down, usually going down about 4 feet. You want to get down out of your organics into a good, hard, what we call parent material. Dig this out, then pack soil back in and continue up through. Now you've taken out that seam. So now the water can't go like this. The water's going to go like this, then come down here and across and then back up. So not only have you made it have to work a longer distance, but now the water's also going to work to climb. Water's lazy. It's not going to want to do that. So that's what's going to hold your dam. And it's called a key because it locks your dam there. And this is the truth. It's got to be like probably 15 years now. But many years ago, there was a dam that let go up in the Somerset County area. And part of that reason that dam let go was because it had water seeping underneath that. And this this structure, the top triangle, could literally slide across the slope. Now, I know it sounds funny, but that's, I mean, it's not going to be like, shoom, going, but it's going to slowly creep and creep, and as more it keeps going, and body motion tends to stay in motion. So that core is so important to lock things into place. I mean, it seems funny that you're digging the soil, and you may be good in soil, and you just have to put it back in, but again, it's to get those different seams, get the different layers, get that compaction consistent going through.
So explain the compaction on that, or
yep. Well, let me give it a try and then follow up with what I miss. So you come through on this, and you're going to want to do it in what we call lifts or in layers. And depending on what type of equipment and how heavy it is, what you're using, you're usually talking 6 to 9 inch layers. If you're coming in and you're doing a huge dam, you may be doing it with like a sheep's foot roller, and then you can go a little bit thicker of layers to get that compaction. But you want to keep layering it just to keep everything compact. As you put in like a 2 foot layer and you drive across it, well, you're only compacting the top 6 inches and the bottom part's not getting the compaction. So you're going to compact that. Then in my diagram, I've got shown this stuff here in the middle, your core of your dam, is got to be your tightest material. This is where the tightest clay bonding soil will be. Now, when you build it, you're building everything at once. You don't just do this tower in the middle. But as the trucks are coming in, bringing in material, you want the tightest stuff here, the next tightest stuff here, and then if you did have on site some stuff that's kind of, a dirty sand, it's not the best, you can put that in the low side. Because basically what that's saying is, as this is all ponded up with water on this end, and it's working, and if it makes its way through these two tight materials, if you give it here, that's when you say, okay, what are you wanting? You give it a free ride, because then it'll just drain out and go on its way if it's made it all the way through there. If you try to dam it up here, that's when you're going to have problems. Once it makes it that far, it's kind of like a filter and just lets it go. So you want to be building that all in layers. A lot of times they'll come in with your trucks and drive your trucks back and forth as they're building up this dam, and that's giving you your compaction. Anything else you want to add on that, Clayton?
No, it used to be that we just packed it with a dozer.
Yeah.
You just had to keep running back and forth over it until you push up 6 more inches and do it.
Yeah. And I'm a big fan of the dozer. I just know a lot of contractors aren't doing dozers as much anymore, so they're doing more and more with the trucks and then smoothing it with an excavator and back and forth. So, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to go about it.
If you've got soil on site that's suitable for doing that, always cheaper than just putting it in with a dozer and tread it off. Or an excavator, put it in place and you tread it with a dozer.
Right.
You're going to have that expense of compaction.
It is, and the other thing to keep in mind, too, is if you have to buy or bring in any material, you have to figure in, and your contractor will figure it for you, but it's not a straight correlation. You have compaction, so you've got some loss, because when that truck comes full, and it's a 14-yard dump, let's say, but once he tracks it down in, you've compacted that soil, and you're not going to get 14 yards in the footprint of it because of the void space. A couple other things on embankments. You see my numbers here, the 2-to-1 and the 3-to-1. That's NRCS standard. What we're saying there is, on the pond side where the water's going to be, you're going to want to have a slope that's 2 feet out from every 1 foot down, minimum. If you want it flatter than that, that's fine. And on the downslope side, it's a 3-to-1, so 3 feet out for every 1 foot down. Now, that's giving us a couple of things. One, it's giving us the mass to make sure that we have enough area to support. And the other thing is, it's giving you, something you can mow, something you can work on. 3-to-1 is still pretty steep, but you can still mow it. And we call for a 6-foot minimum top width. If you're going to use it, obviously, for a roadway, you're going to want something 12, 14, 18 feet wide. Let's see.
You may not have another picture that will show similar, but you really need to have 3 feet at the top of that berm higher than what your water outlet's going to be.
Right. I do actually have that. That talks about the compaction he was talking about. Here is using the dozer, compacting things in place. They're dressing it up using an excavator, sloping it. Please note here, this one, again, this was that pond we were saving. See how the dam actually tips the water to the outside? And so that way it's not rilling in, it's not affecting the pond. If anything on top, it would slope away from your pond. Here's another one. Let me go back. Whoops. So the one thing I want to show is, don't you hate that when the computer doesn't agree? There we go. There's a couple of different spillways. I'm keeping an eye on my time here. I got to speed myself along. This is what they call a split riser, and so that brings your water in, and this goes back to this gentleman's question about how do I maintain a pond level. Now, I don't know what kind of pond you have, sir, but this is a potential if you have a pipe in your pond. The water actually is pulled off the bottom. It comes through here and goes up over this concrete structure, and this is another place that pipes in the bottom. Island. I talked to islands, spillways. There we go. This goes back to what Clayton was just saying. I'll get to pond stuff in a minute, pipe stuff in a minute. Here is, you want your top of dam 3 feet above where you want to hold your pond pool. And this is a straight release pond. So the water's going to spill down this standpipe, often is done out of like a concrete manhole catch basin type thing, and then out your pipe through here. So this right here indicates my core trench or key. This green line is what the natural ground was before we started messing around. This is our dam. And so the purple line would be the bottom of your spillway. The red line would be the top of the emergency spillway. So that's that emergency flow. That's when you have the hurricane come through, the big storm events, whatever, that your pipe can't take the flow. You need an emergency relief. And then the black is the top of it, because you don't want that water right up to the very top of your dam, because if there's a little sag in the dam, if that gets totally saturated, again, it's going to affect its ability to be stable.
Can I ask a question about your core trench? Does the material matter? Does it have to be that tight material, or what should that be?
You're going to want it to be a pretty good tight material. Most of your stuff, unless you're in like a pure sand or gravel, you're not going to want to use that. But any type of a glacial type soil is good. You just don't want it to be real rocky. You want something you can get compaction. If all of a sudden you're trying to compact around a 2 foot rock, it's not going to work for you. But yeah, it's going to be whatever you use. Probably what I call the second tightest material would be a good source. Here's that standpipe. This is a very old picture, but you can see the standpipe and this and how it goes through the dam. See how much higher the dam is? Here's another one that uses plastic. When you do a real big pond, you can go with something that's what they call an anti-seep collar. You can either be these kind of fancier things. And what that is let me see what my next picture is. So the water, this would be the water leaving the pond, but a lot of times you got that smooth pipe. Well, again, that lazy water may say, hey, I'll run along the outside of that pipe and get my way out this way. So what this is, it's like a little cofferdam or a little block dam around that pipe so the water can't pipe along. I'm using the word pipe too much, but can't run along the side of the pipe and erode that out. You can also just build them out of concrete around the pipe. It's just something to make sure that water doesn't, slide along the outside of it. And trash racks are very important to have, not only to control trash in your pond, but also a safety thing, because as your water, in a big storm event, as water's going down through your pipe, you could also have, it has a suction ability, it'll suck, and if anyone got trapped in there, it would suck them right against that grate. So you need to have something to kind of hold your trash back and give someone a chance to not get sucked right against that drain. When I stand here, you can't see, I'm sorry. So then I started to explain a minute ago the split risers, and these are really cool because they take the water from the bottom. So if you have something that's draining off into a prime water, cold water fisheries, you don't want to be taking the top water from your pond because that's the warm stuff. You really want it to be outflowing the stuff that's the cold water. So it would go through this pipe, comes up, and spills over this. And these boards inside the concrete manhole, it's like flash boards inside of there, whatever height they're at will control the pool level. So the water's going to come up, seek its own level, spill over the top, and then go out through here. And what's really cool about this kind of situation is you can pull these boards, and now you can change your pond height. So if you want to do maintenance, clearing it out, drying it down for the winter, whatever the situation is, you can do that. And again, it has those emergency spillway flows that I talked about in the freeboard. So here's what one of those looks like in real life. This is the pipe coming in from the pond. These are the boards. You see how you've got channel irons inside of there? And they'll sit down into those channel iron grooves. And then when the pond is full, see, it saw at the same level as the pond because you think that that's going across, but look at that concrete wearing is dry. That water is actually coming in, filling to that level, and then spilling over those boards. And
on
see.
You're going to show a little bit. On them boards, oftentimes, they'll go halfway by the next one, so it helps seal tight.
Exactly, a shiplap, this is how they refer to it, exactly, to get a better seal to it. And you see right here, they wrote PP, this is called permanent pool elevation. And so that's where that is, but then they could drain it down if they wanted to. And again, there's the steel trash rack on top. Again, in case there's that big storm event, then the water may be spilling over the top and into the structure as well. And then here's that one, same one working. And the reason you see all these crisscross on top of the big plus sign or X is to, you know how your bathroom drain goes, is to keep that vortex from happening. It's an, what they call an anti-vortex device. And so here's that pond. It's not completely filled up yet, but you can see this is where that water would go in. It's going to fill up and around and dump down in and then go on its way. Does that make sense? How? To me, that's one of my favorite ways. It doesn't make sense.
I don't understand how the water goes back up. Comes in lower and comes out.
Because water seeks its own height. So it's going to come up to the same height as the pond water.
But the plant's already going to be filled up. It's coming in from underneath. How would it just rise?
Just because it's going to seek its own. It all has to do with a huge, you know, engineering course about your equal pressures, atmospheric pressures. It's going to eat the same level.
Okay.
So. Again, I've talked a little bit about trash racks. This is a picture from your book of many different styles of trash racks out there. This is not a trash rack. This is not effective. This is not a trash rack because, again, it's such a small area. It's not allowing water into the pipe. It's just little slits in it. The other thing to be concerned with is if you do an embankment pond and you have an outlet structure, you have the pipe going out, be careful because it's going to have some energy at the end of this. I always call culverts a missile launcher for water because that water is just humming out the end of it, and it'll make a big scour hole out here. So you need some rocks, something to take the energy out of that water. And that's what we call, you'll hear folks talk about plunge pools or aprons, and that's what this is. That water can come in here, kind of churn, plunge as it runs into itself, it takes the energy out of it and works its way out through. In the book, you'll see this picture, and this is a no-no in the state of Maine. Reason being is because we have this great stuff called ice. And as your ice would hit on the edge of this pipe, it's going to hit on this edge. And as you know, when water, you know, take any of your ice cubes in the freezer, when that water expands and turning to ice, or when it turns to ice, it expands, and it's going to lift on that pipe. And it's going to keep lifting and lifting. And so if it lifts on that pipe, it's going to be tempted to make a void through here. And now you're going to have a leak in your pond. So this is a great, this publication, again, is a nationwide publication. This is great for Tennessee, not good for us. This goes back to what Mr. Larrabee was talking about, the flat section, and this is probably more what you're remembering, Clayton. So here's your dam, and you have this emergency or auxiliary spillway. It's that engineers are pessimistic people. We're like, okay, when the pipe is plugged up and it's not working because the beavers have plugged it or it's full of trash, and if a big storm hits, we don't want to lose our dam. What's the way we want this thing to fail? Well, it's going to fail by going over this auxiliary emergency spillway, which is just a grass little chute that the water can get around.
But that's put in natural soil. That's not put on the dam itself.
Exactly. Whoops, I thought I had a picture of it. I've got a picture of that in one of the other slideshows. And that's a very good point, because the natural soil, no matter how much we try with the help of Caterpillar and Volvo, we don't compact as well as the glacier did. And so you put that in the natural soil and it won't erode out through. So here's your dam, here's the water, you got a 2-to-1 slope here, a 3-to-1 on that side. One of the things I want to point about this picture is trees in a dam are a no-no. Even small brushy stuff like this, because it's a wind catch, so the wind can start working that tree back and forth, and it can whip that tree, break it off, have a windfall. And now where that root system was, or if the tree dies and you have decaying root systems, now you have a path that that water can leave your pond. It's a threat to the structure of your pond. So keeping that part of your pond mowed and free of trees is very important. So keeping track of my time as best I can. We'll go on to things not to do, because that's my favorite one. I've hit on a few of these already. Well, that's not what I want to do either. Your berm, we've talked about this. It needs to be a well-compacted, clean fill. No big rocks, no organic matter. You know what I mean by organic matter? Sticks, grasses, that kind of stuff. What are your side slopes and your top width? We just went all through that, so I'll spin through it. So here's our no-nos. This is a pond. It's a house. It's a little small pond, a cute little aesthetic thing. But they just didn't have the compaction. They didn't have that freeboard or that gap between the high water and the top of the dam. And they tried to patch it with hay bales, and that didn't work really well. But you see how much rock was in that dam material? And so, again, it just affects your compaction around this material. Here's another one. You can see this is where the low spot was, and it blew out. And so there's a couple things I want to point out with this. Jesus is a bummer. You know, I built this pond and it blew out. Bummer, right? Well, not only is that a bummer, here's another shot of it, and you can see we're on a steep hillside. But where did all that sediment go? It went down here into this water body. So you need to be understanding of what did I just do and how does it affect the world around me. The pipe spill, we talked a little bit about pipe. Make sure it's sized adequately. It's, again, in that blue book, and I think in the pond guidebook as well, it talks about sizing for your pipes. It's kind of based off of your watershed size and how much flow should go through that. Make sure it's installed properly. We've talked about trash protection and ice protection. That's a no-no. Here's one that was done. It was actually done as a stormwater pond in a subdivision. But they put this pipe and they stuck it out a long ways as a low-flow pipe. And that's not really going to work well for them because it became buoyant. So that's the problem there. Here's another one where if they have ice action now in this upper pipe, it's going to do what I showed in that last picture of freeze and thaw and lift. And then like Mr. Larrabee said, here's the rock spillway. It's no lower than my embankment, and it's not on natural material. So this was in one shot. It's everything that you can do wrong. And yes, this is what I do. I drag my husband around. And I'm like, look, honey, look at all the things I did wrong. So here's another one. This was not, my pointer's dying on me. This is not a good place for organic material to hold up your pipe. Again, you didn't have good compaction around it. Here's one. Scott's looking at it. It looks like it's in good shape. They put concrete. They have the pipes coming in. Everything looks good. It's good to go out and check your pond year-round, not just to enjoy it in July and August, see how things are acting. But this is what happened on the other side of it. Things look good on the pond side, but it had lifted up those pipes, like I said, and then this was the erosion that was going on the other side of it. Here's one, again, another subdivision one. And they use, look at all the fill over this pipe, and they use the black plastic pipe. And there's the grate, and see how well that's working for them. But see the pipe and see how much an angle that's at? Well, this is what's going on inside the pipe. One of the things that happened here is when they put all that fill in, they must have had a rock or something, and so it's crushed the pipe here, so you've got some problems there. But the other thing to look at is see how deep the water is there, and then all of a sudden it's a trickle. So the slope inside this pipe changed dramatically. And why is that an issue? Well, here is that same pipe in the wintertime, and you can see how it's got caught up with ice and stuff. So this could potentially plug itself up and have problems. And how many times have we driven down the road and seen a culvert that's plugged up with ice and water all over your road and destroying it? So, you know, it's a realistic problem. And then this is on the outlet side. Yep, they put a little rock in and it looks nice. Except look at this is where, because of the slope of that pipe, that water when it flows is landing right there. And the rock's back here. So that didn't really work well at trying to stabilize the outlet either. Here's one that our agency was involved with a fix on. This was actually built in the 50s, and it just basically wore itself out. And water started to flow around the corrugated metal pipe. It has usually a 30-year life, and so we fixed this about 8 years ago. And no, that's not. Is that right, Adam? Yeah, about that. And we built. Okay. Then that must have been 8 years because before you came on. then this. So if it was built in the 50s, it has a 30-year life, and we fixed it 8 years ago, you can tell it was past its life. So the pipe rusted out, we had a lot of water running, and it actually ate out the soil around that edge of that pipe and caused this cavern. What you're looking at here is one of those big round hay bales, so it kind of shows the hole it made. The emergency spillway or auxiliary spillway, making sure it's sized right, we showed this picture before, and good vegetation. And here's one, it ran, and it held up really well. We got a little bit of a washing right there. It might have been from the water. It might have been because this tends to be a really good party spot, a good place to like a little camp out for the college, high school kids. And so this might have been some four-wheeler truck traffic tires. But so this flowed, it held. You got a little bit of wash out here. This is a pretty inexpensive fix as opposed to trying to replace the whole dam. Here's a spillway that wasn't big enough, and this is what it looks like as it goes through the woods. It's not at all stable. The inlet, I haven't talked a whole lot about the inlet, but it's something to be thought about, and Clayton said this earlier, about what's coming in from your lawn, what's coming in from your neighbors, or you know any abutters, and see how silty and nasty this is. I clicked too soon. So this is actually, you can just see the fence line. This is horse pasture here. You can see there's void of good vegetation, and you get a lot of siltation, and this water's never going to clear itself. Here's one, they were concerned about how the water was getting into the pond, so they rocked it. I think they got a little carried away. Here's, again, this is on a sediment detention pond, and you can see they rocked it, but the flows are just too great, and it's washed itself out. And what's it doing? It's causing this sediment pool in the pond. And here's another one. It was coming off the road, and it washed down through, and Brian's showing how deep that's gullied back in underneath that. Here's one of my favorites. They built, the pond is over here, and this field is what's draining into it. But when they built the pond, you see how this has got a berm? I hope that comes out in the picture. It kind of actually tips back this way. So anything from this field can't come into the pond. I guess that's good for water quality. Whoop. But one of the problems is that this is a dry pond, and it's got a, it didn't hold water, and it's partly for irrigation and partly for fire protection, which, again, those two don't go together, and it's sitting there dry, and so it's literally a dry hydrant. So one last one to go through. And it's pond maintenance, and thank you for those of you that have here for pond maintenance and have sat through all the rest of it, so hopefully it was interesting. Pond maintenance checks. Again, we've talked about having the dams off the trees, the hazards that they can make, making sure your banks are stable and vegetated. Be concerned with safety issues. In this day and age, you need to be careful. Is it real steep? Is it going to be a risk to our neighborhood kids? Is someone going to get hurt at this pond? You might want to have some type of a safety buoy or lifeline of some sort out there at the pond. Keep that kind of stuff in mind. Wildlife control, keep it in control. And that's a tough one to word, because what is your wildlife control issues? Are you concerned about you don't want any wildlife? Maybe you don't want anything coming in because you don't want the otters to be feeding on your trout supply. Maybe you do want the wildlife there. Maybe you don't want the deer because that's bringing them to the area for your gardens or what have you. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And the biggest thing, and I mentioned it earlier, is check your ponds throughout the year. Keep a lookout of it. So here's a pond that was kind of abandoned. You can see all the brush that came up on the berm, and holes have formed basically from lack of attention, animals, different things. There's Brian looking down one of the holes. Here's the water rushing through, and as soon as the water hits that, as you know, erosion, you get a little hole, and then that hole's a little bigger the next year, a little bigger the next year, and you can lose it exponentially growing. Here's one with a tree on it, and you can see there's water coming out here. Obviously, it's following the roots of that tree. And this is a wildlife pond that was built in the early 60s, and there's the control structure, and it's just falling apart, and our pond is nowhere near the level it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be up into here. So check your maintenance of your pond, check your trash racks for debris, make sure your pipe is solid and free-flowing, make sure your spillway is in good shape, your vegetative cover is there, and again, with that emergency spillway, you want to make sure you're mowing it and keeping your trees and whatnot off of it and keeping a good grass stand. Now, I'm not saying it's got to be mowed like your front lawn, but you're probably going to mow it a couple times a year to keep, you know, bush hog it, keep it down that way. And toe drains, we didn't get into toe drains, that's for larger dams, which you probably won't be getting into. Some fixes for some failed pipe spillways. You can line the inside of your pipes with either a fiberglass lining or polyethylene lining. You can replace them, though replacing them is very expensive, because if you're cutting open your dam to replace the pipe, you don't want to just cut it out like you're cutting out a piece of birthday cake. You want to diagonal cut it like this, so again, you get that compaction. Because if you just cut it like it's a piece of birthday cake, you're not going to be able to get good compaction from old dam to replacement dam. And plug, or you can just forget the pipe and plug it and put in a rock spillway to let the water all go that way. Again, a little bit of that's decided about how big of a watershed's feeding the area. Inspect your riser boards and those split risers, and maintain your outlet pool. I talked a little bit about that one. There's the concrete structure that's feeding those pipes, and there's that hay bale sitting in it. Emergency spillway, I talked about mowing it. Check it for after rain events. We talked a little bit about that and that one. We talked a little bit about that, those pictures. Like, again, I have these repeated because I don't always show all the shows. See the height difference here? This is lower and higher. Pond nuisances. Beavers, ducks, frogs, algae, you name it. So you've got your cattails, unwanted wildlife. Domestic animals may be an issue if you're having your cows are getting into it and you're getting green water from manures or horses or whatever. Water temperature is a nuisance. If you can't keep that under control, your temperature goes up, your algae growth and stuff like that is going to go up, and sedimentation issues. There's aquatic pesticides out there. By the state of Maine, it is a governed thing that you need a permit from DEP. It needs to be applied by a certified aquatic pest control, and the reason being is they don't want it entering the waters of the state of Maine. So you may like your pond. You may want to put those blue tablets in it that make it look like it's Caribbean blue. They don't want that because they don't want that releasing to the waters. And they will allow it case-by-case basis if you're showing that your pond is a health, the problem with your pond is a health risk, an economic hardship. Let's say that the sediments and what have you are an issue and affecting you being able to grow your gardens, which is your livelihood, or if it's you've lost your use of it because it's being choked out by weeds. Algae. There's a bunch of different ways to try to attack algae. Again, that pond guidebook, the tan-covered one, really goes more into these maintenance items than the blue one does. One is to remove by hand. One is to aerate, because your algae is growing because there's not enough oxygen and the water's warm. Those are the two big things that are driving your algae. Sometimes you can do biological things, like stocking a certain type of minnow, which will eat it. Barley bales, and that's one of those that's really has taken off as a way to go about it. You can get a lot of those. They have like balls you can float, or you can just get barley straw and stuff it in like an onion bag. Farm Tech and some other magazines, even I think Gardener Supply, those kind of places talk about using those things. And then again, the chemical. Something, see, I didn't pay attention in that part of chemistry, but there's something of an enzyme released in the barley that actually helps counteract the algae growth. And it tells you how much when you read, like in the pond Garden Supply Handbook or in Farm Tech, it'll tell you how much to use per size of your pond. And it's just something about the enzymes of the barley straw that helps kill off the algae. And I've talked to folks here in Maine, and it does seem to work well for them.
Where can we get flathead minnows?
To get any type of fish in, you need to talk to the Maine State Inland Fisheries, and to stock with any kind of fish, you have to get a permit from them, so they should be able to tell you where to find them. So here's just a pond that's got some algae growth on it. Now, is algae growth a horrible thing? It's an aesthetic thing. If that bothers you, it's part of the food chain. It's providing some food source for some critters. You obviously don't want to overtake your pond, but a little isn't that horrible. So, I mean, it's a personal preference. Clayton earlier was saying about, think about what's draining right into your pond. Here's a yards. You want to be very careful about your pesticides and fertilizers and whatnot that you use here, because that's going right into your pond. Here's that same pond. They've done a nice job over here. They've got a nice vegetative buffer that's letting it grow up natural. That other shot had a birch tree in it. Trees are nice because it's providing you some shade and some structure for whatever's in the pond. But then you also have the leaf litter that's dropping in, which is, as those leaves start breaking down, is an oxygen consumer. So it's a catch-22. But one of the things, I've done this talk before with a biologist at the same time, and one of the things that he would mention was that you don't want to have your pond, if you want wildlife to come, you don't want your pond out in the middle of nowhere, because that's like you wanting to walk into the grocery store in your underwear. You feel very exposed. Doesn't that stick with you? It's stuck with me all the time. So if you have your woods coming up to the edge of your pond, yes, you're going to get some of that leaf litter into your pond, but also your wildlife are going to feel better because they can like be hiding out in that hemlock stand and then step out to your pond. Cattails, mechanical removal, because they're a tubular type plant, and so their tubes are all attached. So if you cut off the top, the root system's still in place and keep feeding it. You can cut them with a sickle bar or a weed whacker. Some folks will put down black plastic to shade it out and kind of choke it out from daylight. This gentleman talked about lowering his pond. I know some folks that have done that, is you lower your pond and then it freezes it out and then they don't come back.
You can eat them.
You can eat them. People can harvest them and eat them, and they can make a tea, I think, too. I don't know. There's a bunch of stuff that you can do with it. So weed and pull, fight with them, throw up the white flag and call it good birding habitat. Unwanted wildlife, the muskrats are a big concern. I mentioned weasels and stuff. Muskrats, because they'll burrow into the slope. Some folks say you can put chicken wire down on the edges because then they can't burrow in. However, that's kind of annoying to sit there and bury chicken wire. So the biggest thing is trapping, seeing if you can get a trapper in if you wanted to, something like that. Again, changing that water level so they can't figure out where their houses should be. And beavers play a radio. Last I heard, they're kind of into Taylor Swift, but they don't like, no, I'm not sure what kind of music it is, but. So lights, please. So there's my presentation, and I talked longer than I meant to.
I'd rather be a farmer. I'd rather work the land. I'd rather see the mountainsides. I'd rather see your hand. I'd rather swim the ocean. I'd rather not pretend. I'd rather do some thinking now. Somehow it all depends. If I could fly away from me, to ride this wind above the tree. I'd rather see my hometown. I'd rather hold my wife. I'd rather never question things. That's the story of my life. I'd rather not be crying. I'd rather just be whole. I'd rather brave the cleansing fire. I'd rather feed my soul. If I could fly away from me, to ride this wind above the tree. Open to suggestions. I'm crying out to you. I'm ready to be finished here. I'm ready for this season to be if I could fly away from me, to ride this wind above the trees, and oh, to fly face the longing. Whoa.